comments, thoughts, questions. Yeah.
Of the 600 people who were captured and tortured after 9/11, did any bring suit against the U.S.?
I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think so. It's been very difficult for people to bring suit for torture, and partly, now this is a slightly different case because what was done was actually done by a police force in Brooklyn rather than by any of the secret agencies. I don't know the answer, and it would be interesting to find out. I know that other people who have tried to bring suit haven't been able to. So Maher Arar, for example, who was a Canadian computer programmer who was kidnapped by the U.S. when he came through Kennedy Airport and was sent to Syria and was tortured there for 10 months. He did try to sue the U.S. and was told he couldn't because the information about what had happened to him was secret. But that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. It would be a good thing if they did. Does anybody else?
That's in Tram Nguyen's book.
Oh, right. Okay. Tram Nguyen wrote a book called We Are All Targets Now. And it's about the experience of immigrants in this country after September 11th. And she actually writes about that. So it's Tram, T-R-A-M, Nguyen, N-G-U-Y-E-N. And definitely worth looking at. Good point. Other questions? Yeah, Jim.
Not a question, just a comment. The book is really good.
And it is available for sale here, and I am happy to sign copies. I want to just say one other thing. In the book, I talk a little bit about how I think torture deforms particular moral qualities that each of us have, and I talk about four key qualities, which are courage, wisdom, temperance, or moderation, and my most important and favorite virtue, which is practical wisdom, which is the wisdom, it's the intellectual or mental virtue that allows you to make good judgments about what you ought to do and what's the best way to go about doing that thing. And I talk about specific ways that each of one of those gets distorted and deformed by torture. Yeah.
It's easy for me to guess, but what are the spiritual consequences?
Oh, very good question, actually. Okay, so I think the spiritual consequences, and you guys who are historical materialists out there, just, you know, hold on to your hats for a minute. If we broaden spiritual to include questions about right connection with the earth, with other people, with society, or with the divine, if you happen to believe in the divine, which some of us do, I would say that they're profound. So, as I say, torture, because it's a practice, creates moral habits in us. These are like stable ways of behaving in the world. So Aristotle, my guy, says, you become brave by doing brave things. You become cowardly by doing cowardly things. So one of the ways that torture distorts courage is in the people who practice it, there is a particular kind of courage that allows us not to be squicked out by other people's pain. And you know that human beings have these mirror neurons, which we now are beginning to understand a little bit, which actually on a physiological basis cause us to suffer when we see other people suffering. And sometimes you need to be able to suppress that reaction. And sometimes that's a good thing, say if you're a doctor and you need to set somebody's bone while they're conscious because you don't have a choice about it. You need to be able to repress that fear of causing pain. But in torture, what happens is that kind of courage actually gets transformed into a willingness to experience other people's pain and not be affected by it. And in fact, under the Nazis, this was considered also a virtue. And there's a famous passage that J. Lifton talks about a Nazi doctor who wrote a resignation letter because he did not have the courage, he said, to condemn mentally retarded children to death, that he was and did not have the courage to do what he knew was the right thing, which was to clean the race by having mentally retarded children killed. But he couldn't do it, and he resigned. So his understanding of courage is very similar to the torturer's understanding of courage. Moderation is sort of the virtue. If courage is the virtue that helps us to deal with things we're afraid of or dislike, moderation is the virtue that helps us deal with things that attract us and keeps us from being too attracted. So keeps us from getting addicted to things or harming ourselves or other people because we like something too much. And but in torture, that same moderation is used to identify the good torturer, because people who torture as professionals believe that someone who enjoys it too much is actually not a good torturer. Similarly, practical wisdom, the wisdom about understanding what's right, gets distorted terribly. And one of the most important ways is by allowing us to refuse to see what's right in front of us, to refuse to see torture because it's ordinary practice in our jails, to refuse to see if we watch a police procedural in which the perp is threatened that if he goes to jail, he's going to be raped, so he better talk, right? Which we see, you know, 10 times a night, it's on television, and yet rape is torture in prison when you can't, you know, when it's in an institutionalized form, and yet we just accept it. I also talk in the book a little bit, very briefly, about the three Christian graces, which are called faith, hope, and love. And I talk about how torture actually also makes those impossible, both for the people who do it and also for people who accept it as the price of their own safety, and how by enacting faith, hope, and love, we actually can, which I also call solidarity, we can actually overcome torture.
You said that the purpose of torture is not to get information, but to destroy the cohesion of the social group and stuff like that.
Right.
I was wondering, what is this your own discovery, or how? What's the history of this understanding, and do the people who practice torture share that understanding, or do they actually think they're getting information?
Right. That is a really good question. So, no, it's not my own. It's not my own observation alone. A number of people have written about torture. William Kavanaugh, Elaine Scarry, even Foucault really understands that it's not about that the way that torture works is as a means of imposing power. And so this is not original to me. However, the question of what people think they're doing is a really interesting one. And I think the answer is it depends on who the person is and at what level they are involved. So, for example, the people at Abu Ghraib, who, by the way, in civilian life, the reason that they were at Abu Ghraib is that in civilian life, they were actually corrections officers in West Virginia. And so there's a direct connection between torture and the war on terror. And in fact, one of the ringleaders famously wrote home in an email, "The Christian in me knows it's wrong, but the corrections officer in me loves to see a grown man piss himself." So these folks, what they believed was that they were demonstrating to the really important interrogators how good they were at softening up and creating the conditions for interrogation. So they actually believed that they were involved in interrogation. It's possible also that the interrogators at the higher level believe that to some extent, although it would have become pretty clear pretty immediately that there was no battlefield intelligence to be gotten, because battlefield intelligence has a very short shelf life. It's only useful for, you know, a couple of hours, maybe a couple of days, and the people who were tortured at Abu Ghraib had been there for weeks or months, so they didn't actually have information. I would say at the level of a government that imposes a torture regime, whether or not they consciously know it, they continue to do it because it has that effect, because it successfully does that. And the classic example, of course, is in modern history, is the use of torture by the French in Algeria to break the National Liberation Front. So anybody who has read about that or has seen the Battle of Algiers knows that they used the torture of maybe 50,000 young Arab men pretty much the entire young male population of the Arab quarter of Algiers were systematically tortured in order to identify what were really a very small number of members of the cells of the FLN. And in fact, temporarily, they did succeed. They also tortured a whole lot of people who had nothing to do with it. And so it's true that they believed they succeeded by identifying the members of the cells. And so in a sense, it was through the information. But what was more important was that they destroyed temporarily the will of the people to resist the French occupation. Now, that didn't last. And this is the other thing that it's important to say, is that even though this is why torture regimes do it, they don't last forever. Pinochet is gone. Franco finally, died. The Portuguese finally got rid of their fascists. The Greek junta is no longer in charge. Marcos doesn't run the Philippines anymore. The Uruguayan, the Chilean, the Argentinian, the Brazilian regimes are gone. Torture doesn't work forever, but that doesn't keep people from doing it. I don't know if that answers your question. What else? Okay. Yeah.
I think it's just a comment and a question related to that.
Yeah.
Would you say it's inappropriate then? Because it has this effect of trying to soften resistance or fight.
Mm-hmm.
It's a form of terrorism itself.
That's an interesting question. So terrorism is a word that is very poorly defined, right? I mean, there are definitions, but it's a kind of elastic definition depending on who's using it and what they want to use it for. But most people, I think, define terrorism as attacks on civilian population for political purposes by some kind of political entity, and generally involving creating tremendous fear. I mean, that's a pretty good definition. So I would say, to some extent, yes, it is now a form of terrorism. But I'm not sure it's a useful concept, really, for me. Because, the war on terror is basically a war on a tactic. And I think creating fear in a civilian population is a terrible tactic. But I'm not sure it's actually as cohesive a thing as torture is. I think it's more a collection of tactics. Jan?
You sometimes talk about the particular effect that you think torture has in a democracy.
Oh, that's really important. Yeah, because a lot of these regimes I'm talking about are, of course, totalitarian or authoritarian regimes. The U.S. is at least nominally a democracy. And so the question is, in the war on terror, was the torture that was or is being done primarily being done to affect the citizens of this country by making them afraid to resist the government? And I would say no. I would say yes, in Iraq and in Afghanistan, definitely the point was to make sure that there was no organized insurgent armed resistance to the U.S. occupations. But in the United States, I'd say it's a little different, depending on who you are. So if you are a Muslim, if you are a person of Middle Eastern descent, or in some other way part of a group that actually is organizing to try to overthrow the U.S. government, yeah, it works to frighten you. But for most U.S. citizens, I think it works differently. And this is important. It's William Kavanaugh has a great expression. He calls it the striptease of power. And other people have talked about security theater. And the idea here is that we start with the supposition that the United States is the defender par excellence of human rights in the world. Right? Now, that's not my supposition, but many people in this country believe, because they don't know any better, that the United States, the thing that makes us unique and special and exceptional in the world, is our commitment to democracy and human rights. Therefore, as it becomes clear to us, as the striptease happens and we see a little bit here and a little bit there of what the U.S. is doing, we can make the argument in our minds that My government is a good government. My government protects human rights. If my government is forced to do such terrible things, think how terrible the danger must be to me. Think, you know, what kind of danger we are in if the government is forced to do these terrible things. And so it's a way, in that sense, we are the targets. We are the target audience for torture. And the message of the play is, you should be very much afraid, and only your government can save you, and you know it's really dangerous because look at the terrible things we have to do.
Let's make this the last question.
Okay, this has got to be the last question.
There are all the people, 2.5 million people in prison in the U.S., many in solitary confinement, and many minority groups.
Yes.
The U.S. government torturing people to get these minority groups to back off somehow?
I don't know about that, but what I will say is that, yes, this torture is happening within the context of the prisons to break up the organizations that exist within the prisons that resist the prison. So we're not talking at the level of the federal government. We're talking about the level of within the prison structure itself. It's definitely used to break up the prison as a microcosm of society, to break up those groups. I would say absolutely that the threat of prison, with everything that it means, and including the increased police the way that policing happens in communities of color and poor communities, but especially in Black communities and Latino communities, there's no question that the threat is, it's not even secret, it's just right out there, the threat of violence and the threat of prison with everything that that entails. No question about it, that that is designed as a means of control of groups of people who have been, to some extent, completely excluded from the labor system, groups of people that capital no longer has a use for. And so they are kept under control through violence, through torture. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.